Chapter 38 is rated PG, to say the least, because of its the immorality involved. The story of Judah and Tamar is certainly not one of the most pleasant stories in the Bible. In fact, most commentaries just kind of pass over it and doesn't spend a whole lot of time on it. And you probably haven't heard very many sermons on it either. What we have here is a story basically about bloodline, to prove bloodline, that Jesus came from Judah, Judah's bloodline. But the story also relates to cultural information of the era, as well as historical data, and you can find links to later times, to cities and people. And Genesis 38 tells us about people who are in Jesus' bloodline, and that's the important coverage that we need to know. Now, the story of Judah and Tamar is placed in the middle of the story of Joseph because that's where it happened. It happened right after Joseph was sold into slavery, and it happens before the rest of the family goes to Egypt. And although this story really doesn't put a whole lot of good highlights on Judah, because most of it about Judah is bad. But then again, we can find the accounts of the lineage in Luke 3:33 and Matthew 1:3 that showed Perez as the son of Judah, through which Jesus descended. The Messiah is a descendant, but why take the long way of going through all of this? You know, why the long version? Most of the time, if you have something, it's just a one-liner, you know, said, such and such begat such and such, you know. But this, they go through the whole thing, and they tell you the whole story, and it's proof that this happened. But first, I want to give you a little background, because the first part of the chapter goes by the Levirate law, okay? And that has nothing to do with Levi. It's what it means is the L-E-V-I-R. That first part of the word is a Latin word that means brother-in-law. And it states that if a married man dies without having an heir, that his next brother in line is to marry his wife and have a child for him to carry on his name. And if that, we're going to find out that that doesn't always work out. And so the reason for this is also that his name be carried on and that his widow would have someone to take care of her. Because they didn't have any social security system back then. Your son was your social security system because he took care of you when you got older. And this is also in Deuteronomy 25, a lot of the story. But there's another part of this. Not everybody wanted to marry his brother's wife. And the other part of it says that if a brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel, he is not willing to perform the duty as a husband to the wife, then the wife is to go to the city gates and meet the elders. And when they're there, she tells them that my brother-in-law doesn't want me. He doesn't want to marry me. He doesn't want to have a child with me. So then the elders at the main gate would call the brother-in-law and ask him just point blank, do you want to marry her? And if he says no, then what they do, it's a ceremony. It's called the ceremony of the shoe. A sandal, whatever it is. And what they'll do is the brother-in-law and the sister-in-law will meet at the gate in front of the elders, and he'll sit in a chair, and he'll have a sandal on, and she'll take that sandal off, and she'll throw it. Then she'll spit at him. And then once that's done, she's no longer in the family. His obligation is no more, and her obligation is no more. She has nothing more to do with the family. So that's the other part of it. But what it does, it puts shame on the family. And she, you know, he's known from then on as the guy who wouldn't take care of his sister-in-law throughout the community. It was basically something to shame him. And that's what it does. And it's called the halitza, is what that process is called. And that's also in Deuteronomy 25:5-10. Okay, could I get someone to read Genesis 38:1-11?
There, Judah met the daughters of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and made love to her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was Kazib that she gave birth to him. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, "Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offsprings for your brother." But Onan knew that the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's household until my son, Shelah, grows up," for he thought he might die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's household.
All right, now it said, after the sale of Joseph, Judah is about 20 years old. Remember that Joseph was 17 when they sold him, and Judah is about 20 years old when he parts ways with his brother and his daddy. Okay, you can kind of understand why he wanted to get away from his brothers. You know, because about this time, it said, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi are kind of all fell out of favor with the daddy because of incest and treachery. So that kind of puts him up to like firstborn status. You know, that's probably not real good to be with that bunch because they just sold the younger brother off. So, And something else, he probably really felt bad about being around his daddy because his daddy was still in mourning so much. Knowing he lied to him and what he had taken part in everything they had done. So he really didn't want to be in that area with those guys. So he took off. And he's going to spend the next 23 to 25 years away from the family. He's going to start his own family. He's going to marry a Canaanite girl. He's going to have 3 kids. That said, Onan, and the name that was, I would say Shelah, but it's called Shelah. I guess Shelah when it's a guy and Shelah when it's a girl. I don't know. So when reaches about 17 years old, his daddy goes find him a wife. Well, that's kind of strange in itself again, you know. Said sometimes they find their own and sometimes he found his own, you know. I guess he wanted to pick better for his son than what he had picked. So the Lord took Ur's life because he was wicked. You know, I looked all over it. I couldn't really find any reason, you know, why it had happened. So then Judah instructs Onah the second son, and he's about 17 years old. He instructs him to marry her. Well, he follows through with the wedding and all this other stuff. Basically, if you say you're married, you know. So even if you're engaged, you're basically married. You're in the family. But he decided that he really didn't want to have a kid for his brother. And if you stop and think about it, now if he had a kid for his brother, the kid wouldn't be his. And then, see, the kid would have firstborn status. The kid would get a double portion of everything. So he would lose basically almost half of the inheritance to the kid that he didn't want. That's not his. And there was no guarantee that he would have another kid on his own. So he was wicked in the eyes of the Lord. He performed his own birth control, and now he's gone. So he's got one son left. He's about 16 years old. He said he's a little young to marry. So what he does, he says, look, he said, why don't you just go on back and live with your daddy? You're still engaged. Now, once they said you're engaged. You know, it's just like you're married. So why don't you just go live with your daddy, you know, live at your daddy's house, and what we'll do is when my son gets of age, we'll let you marry. And then you can conceive and you can have a son for Ur. Well, several years passed, and the son was of age. Shelah was of age. But Judah didn't want to let her marry him. He was scared. Why was he scared? He said, she's already killed two of my sons. That's kind of what he was thinking, you know. She's done the killing, you know. She's the black widow here. It's kind of like the rest of us, you know. Our kids don't do anything wrong. You know, so our kids didn't have any, not involved in that. And he put all the blame on her. Okay, can someone read 12 through 23, please?
Judah was comforted and went up to the sheep herders at Timnah, and he and his friend Hara, the Adullamite, we're not being graded on these pronunciations.
No, you keep going. Okay. You did a fine job, son.
All right. And it was told to Tamar, saying, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garment, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and said in the open place, which is on the way to me. Yeah, that town.
Timnah.
Okay. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not giving him for a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought that she was a harlot because he had covered her face. And he turned into her by the way and said, please, let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, What will you give me that you may come into me? And he said, I will send a young goat from the flock. So she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? And he said, what pledge shall I give you? So she said, your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. How far you want me to read?
23.
All right. And so she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. Then he asked when the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside? And they said, there is no harlot in this place. So he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. Also the men of the place said there was no harlot in this place. Then Judah said, let her take them for herself, lest we be shamed, for I sent this young goat, and you have not found her.
Okay, at this point, Tamar is back at her father's house, and somebody in the community tells her that her father-in-law is coming to town. Okay? They didn't say that Judah's coming to town, it's your father-in-law is coming to town. You know, they don't, I think the community's kind of telling that, you know, they kind of see what's going on and they kind of on her side. You know? She's already been twice wedded and promised the third son. And now the townspeople here are likely to suggest that she take her fate in her own hands. Because as of now, she kind of felt like a used person. She had been taken for Ur. She had been given to Onan. She was told to go back to her father's house, and she was promised Shelah. So the townspeople are kind of saying, you kind of need to do something about your marital status. You know, you need to kind of take care of yourself. Maybe, and just maybe someone told her about the Syrian law number A33, or maybe the Hittite inheritance practices, which also kind of, you know, besides being just the brother-in-law, they throw the father-in-law in there. So, I mean, she probably didn't come up with this idea by herself. And it also throws in nephews and further down the line. So they kind of got the wheels going. So here she is. She says she's concerned. Said Judah was concerned. She was a cursed woman. And because Judah was not faithful to his promise, Tamar decided to take matters in her own hands. Her goal was to have a son to mean security in her later life. And after Judah, now Judah, in the meantime, his wife has died. And he goes through the 30 days of mourning. So, and then after 30 days of mourning, he's looking for a prostitute. Where she's been over 3 years, and he could care less about her. So they hear that he's coming to shear sheep. And I understand that's kind of like Mardi Gras there. You know, it's a happy time. You know, just everything going on. So, you know, and then he's hanging out with his buddy Hira again. Said, kind of every time, I don't know if you noticed it, but kind of every time you hear the name Hira, there's kind of a little mischief going on. He might be one of those guys that your folks didn't want you to hang around with, you know. Said, I had an old buddy of mine that my daddy used to tell me all the time. He said, his name was Pap. We called him Papoose. And my daddy would say, he said, man, there's just one thing you can't take away from him. He said, he's no good, and you can't take that away from him. Okay, in verse 14, Tamar decides to play the prostitute. She finds some temple garments. And this is kind of, Tamar knowing that she could trap Judah by deception is saying very little of what she thought about him. If she thought she could do this and get away with it, she didn't think a whole lot of her father-in-law. She predicted that her widowed father-in-law would be going to shear sheep. And he wouldn't be carrying any money because he probably didn't carry any money where he went. So she said, you know, how's he going to pay a prostitute? He doesn't have any money. So that's, the wheels are rolling. Said, kind of like I was reading something today, desperate people do desperate things. And she also knew that once she had a child with Judah as the father, her ties with the family would be dissolved. She wouldn't be part of that family anymore unless she wanted to be. She veiled herself, even though prostitutes in ancient times didn't usually do this. And she did this so Judah wouldn't discover who she was. After having sex, he promised to send her a goat. But she said, well, I need more than your promise, because she's already had his promise a while back. You know, so she says, I need some collateral. So she takes his little seal. And what that is, that's just a stone with some carving on it. And it's just like your signature. You know, what they do with that is on clay or wax, they stamp it. You know, you kind of seen these in movies before, you know, where they put some wax and they stamp it closed. And that's basically what that was for. And then the cord was so it went around his neck. And then again, the staff was a long stick, and it had carvings on it and stuff like that. And that said most people didn't need the stick to walk with. They just needed it to fight off small animals and stuff like that. But it was just like, you know, if you have something that you know is yours, you'll recognize it. And that's what she was hoping that would happen. And getting back to the religious shrine and prostitutes, and fornication was part of the worship of the pagan Canaanites, their fertility gods. And the prostitutes usually didn't sit around the streets. Said, however, just because sin was culturally accepted doesn't mean that Tamara was justified in using it to obtain her goal. And just because Judah was using a prostitute, because it was legal, still doesn't make it right. Although the passage of the scriptures doesn't appear to condemn Judah or Tamar for their sinful behavior, God certainly doesn't take sexual sin very lightly. Throughout the scripture, God condemns adultery and fornication as serious sins. Now, Judah promised the prostitute a small goat as payment. But Tamar insisted that she get his seal, his cord, and his staff as pledge that he'll fulfill his promise. Okay, Judah gave it to her. So he leaves, and she leaves. She takes off her stuff, goes back home, puts on her mourning garments again. She's back in mourning again. Okay, and then in the meantime, he sends his buddy Hira with a goat. He's standing there with a goat. He's asking these guys, he said, where was the prostitute that was here? They said, there isn't any, and I don't know there has been any. So he goes back and he tells Judah that there's nobody there. I still got the goat, and she still got your stuff. So he's starting to kind of feel, you know, maybe my reputation might be, you know, kind of look bad here. He said, I'm just going to go drop the whole thing. But the thing about that little signet thing is, if you don't have that, everything that you've done with that thing is null and void. So it's like, you know, losing your checkbook with a bust your check signed. You know, it's not yours anymore. Okay, then probably several months down the line, the town people play another role. Okay, they tell her that there's nobody there. So the town people are kind of involved in this. I don't know if you've noticed that. So they're kind of moving things along. Okay, can we read Genesis 24 through 30? Can someone read that for us?
Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. And it came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was Zerah.
All right. Now, 3 months have passed since the episode, and somewhat the townspeople again let the father-in-law know that she's going to have a kid. So the father-in-law kind of gets all huffy. And it goes on to say here that they're going to have twins, just like the situation with Rebecca. The signs were there. The people play a role the third time, announcing that Tamar is pregnant and casting aspersions that she played the harlot. Her sin wasn't prostitution, it was adultery, because she was engaged to the son. Judas says, burn her at the stake. She's going to burn for this. When the law required to be stoned. Now, for unusual wickedness, that's in Leviticus, that was 20, Leviticus 20, 14, and 21, 9. For unusual wickedness, you would burn. Why was Judah demanding such a harsh treatment for his daughter-in-law? Can anybody think that through? Why was he demanding so much of her? Maybe it was because he was kind of overcompensating for his own.
I believe his pride was hurt.
What's that?
His pride.
Well, that's true. The family pride. Yeah, family was everything. Family pride. Often we attempt to cover up our own sinfulness by the severity of the response, the sin of others, you know. On the other hand, it may have even been more devious. Think that through. Why did he want to get rid of her? Well, let me say it like this. If she's gone, I don't have a problem. Yeah, because, you know, said I didn't have to do anything to her. She did it to herself, and I don't have a problem anymore. Okay, when Tamar is being dragged out of the house, out of her father's house, she's being taken to be executed. She sends the seal, the cord, and staff to Judah. And at this point, he could have said, I've never seen that stuff before. You know, he could have said that and maybe got away with it. But he said, this is mine. And she probably doesn't have to say as much as, you're the father, but he knows he's the father. And then he says that you are more right than I am. Okay, and verse 26 says that Judah no longer slept with her, yet she remained in his house. She gives birth to twins. And Perez is the progenitor of the line of David, and Ruth 4, 18 to 22. Okay, the role of the townspeople in this episode is just significant. They, not the male characters, just keep it rolling. They'll tell Tamar that Judah's on his way to shear sheep, suggesting that it's time for her to act. Since they report that there is no prostitute in the street, and then they also report that she's pregnant. So they keep the thing going along. Now, Judah's characterized as pretty much of a scoundrel here. He's evasive, he's hot-headed, where Tamar is shown as clever, level-headed, and resolved. Tamar, she's portrayed more positive than Judah is, and in her time and place in history, that wasn't the case, usually. She gave birth to twins, Perez and Zerah. Genesis 46, 12. The children born to Tamar are not numbered as children of Ur. Why is that?
Because he was the dad, he was the father or the head of the household.
Okay, but... Okay, he didn't do the Levirate law. Why was that? Why wouldn't he consider that? He never married her.
Well, and also she was engaged to his son at the time.
Yeah.
You know, she was engaged to Judah's son, and then Judah stepped in and did his thing, and so the whole thing was just messed up. So Judah gets the credit where credit is due, I guess.
Okay, I think this might work out good. I got probably 5 or 6 minutes, and I got 2 pages left, but I can drag that out. In case you're wondering why Judah told Tamar that you are more righteous than I, he doesn't mean that Tamar was righteous in the sense that she was holy and perfect. It means that she was more righteous to act the way she did than the way he did, because he was supposed to give his son to her and didn't. It was right for Judah to make the promise, but he didn't fulfill the promise. And she figured out that he didn't intend to keep the promise. God was present in the situation because he protected Tamar in a world where widows are often left uncared for, and in doing so, allowed her to produce the heir that would ultimately lead to Jesus Christ. The text also has a rarity of ancient literature because it exemplifies a woman while looking poorly on the three men in the story. Judah and the two wicked sons, Ur and Onan, are portrayed as very badly in the text. Yet Tamar is actually mentioned in Matthew's genealogy in Matthew 1:3, mentioning a woman's genealogy is also unheard of in the first century. And furthermore, despite Judah's sin, God is still moving. Isn't it interesting that through Judah's line that the Savior would come and not through Joseph? Joseph was the great handsome hero in Egypt whose parallel narrative is far more captivating than Judah's. Yet God's son came from Judah's line, not Joseph's. We should all remember that whenever we think that we don't measure up, when we think we have made too many mistakes to make a difference, and when we think that others outshine us, Judah is a seemingly great example of this. God uses us anyway. These events took place anywhere from 3 to 5 years before they went to Egypt. And I looked up at the 70 people that went to Egypt, and I didn't find Tamara's name in there. I don't know what really happened to her. I looked for, well, my problem is I had too much time on my hands, and I looked for 2 weeks almost where I could find her. and I never did. Okay, and the irony of this whole thing is Shelah, when he got married, his firstborn son he named Ur for his brother. And practical applications from 35 is don't be too quick to point the finger at other people. And another one is keep your promise. And third is fulfill your family obligations. Thank you.